Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. A theme which runs through the majority of what I cover on The Appropriate Omnivore is fermentation. One of the best fermented foods you can consume is sauerkraut. Here to talk with me about it is Holly Howe, author of the book Mouthwatering Sauerkraut and founder of the website Make Sauerkraut. Holly, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm glad you can come on. I know you've been doing a lot with your book and your website and the classes you teach, so I appreciate you taking the time out and stopping by here.
Excellent.
Yes. So what drew you to fermentation in the first place?
About 20 years ago, I came across a book called Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon. And diving into that and hearing about the backstory on it was Dennis Weston A. Price, who was looking, he saw the health of his patients' teeth degrading over time. And he was curious why all of a sudden people did not have the nice teeth that they should have. So he went and searched around the world for cultures with perfect teeth and then looked at what they ate and how those foods were prepared. And it was a perfect time to be studying these cultures around the world that were isolated and was just processed foods were coming into their diets. And so all of a sudden they were eating white flours and white sugars and canned fruits and vegetables and could see within a family a change in their dental health. And he has wonderful pictures showing kind of before and after processed foods. And he found 14 cultures around the world. And a common thread through all those 14 cultures was they all ate some type of fermented food. And I went, wow, well, that's easy. I'm going to try a fermented food. And not even knowing what fermented foods were, hearing about sauerkraut, I did not grow up eating it. It was that nasty stuff on a hot dog that tastes nothing like the homemade sauerkraut that you can make. And so I pulled out Sally Fallon's book and looked at her recipe and followed it and started making my own sauerkraut for the family. We had first started buying it from Bubby's, but that got rather expensive. So we swapped over to making our own. And here I am today with a website and a book because I find it such an easy ferment to make. It goes well with so many foods and it can improve your gut health and support your gut microbiome in so many ways.
The Weston A. Price Foundation was also what drew me into fermentation. Now, I know a little bit about sauerkraut, same way I was turned off by it. I did know some other fermented foods such as pickles. So there was some fermentation in my background that I didn't really realize what was fermented because I had actually eaten fermented pickles and not those pasteurized pickles that you find on the shelves in supermarkets. So back then I knew a little bit that I liked fermentation. And when I tried real sauerkraut, I ended up really liking it. It's much different than the stuff you'll see at the baseball game where they throw on that dead sauerkraut onto your hot dog.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people in their mind, that's what they think about. And 20 years ago, when I made my first batch of sauerkraut, the only available, quote, raw sauerkraut naturally fermented was Bubby's. And even researching deep into that, they do a quick pasteurization of theirs. So it's not completely raw. But yeah, so that's what's in people's memories now. But nowadays, we can find plenty of homemade sauerkraut in stores. It's much more readily available. But then it starts getting expensive. You're trying to consume it on a regular basis. But it is important that people understand the difference between raw sauerkraut and canned sauerkraut, because if it's found down the aisle, it's been heat pasteurized and canned, and that's not going to have the probiotic benefits of the raw sauerkraut that you'll find in the cooler section. And it will say raw on it. It will say unpasteurized. If you look at the ingredients, there won't be any nasty things in there. You'll just see the vegetables and the salt. There's no vinegar in the process of making sauerkraut, and there's no heat to it. So if you're wanting to consume sauerkraut for the microbiome, the gut health benefits, you want to make sure, and same with the pickles, that you're getting raw. And that's easier to get today. And then it's easy to learn how to make your own.
Yes, we're seeing more of both of them, certainly. So from learning about fermentation through Nourishing Traditions, Dr. Weston Price, Sally Fallon, how did it then evolve into starting up a website for it?
Friends started asking me how to make it. They were curious about it, and I'd give them little tips. And then I have friends come over to my house and we'd make it. And then before I knew it, I wanted to reach more people. So then I started giving local workshops. And it wasn't until after I did a handful of local workshops that I wanted to find an easier way to reach more people and get their information out there. So in 2014, that would have been about 15 years after I started making it, I went ahead and put the website together. And that was a fairly new topic out there in the web and for people searching. And so I quickly grew my website because I was one of the few people putting it out there. But since then, there are many, many websites and many, many people on Instagram and the different social channels that are out there teaching it. And I've teach other ferments, but I've stayed focused on the sauerkraut and I've added in the kimchi. So when we published my book, we added in the kimchi. And I love to see the two different ferments and how advantageous they are. But sauerkraut is just so simple to make. It's an easy first ferment. People generally have what they need. They don't have to get any mystery ingredients. So then it bubbled into a website and then a book. And now we're here today trying to reach more people.
Very similar, really, to how I started doing the appropriate omnivore, because a lot of people ask me that. And it's pretty much originally I had the term an appropriate omnivore about eating the right food, whether it's meat or vegetables and fruits. And people said, yeah, why don't you make this into a blog? And then I got someone interested in carrying what was then an internet radio show. So I very much relate to it. You just start talking about it, and everyone wants to hear more.
Yeah, people are curious. They want to be able to take care of their health, and sometimes they need assistance with that. We're all different on how we learn. But once you taste it and once you experience the process, it's really rather magical that you think about it. Because when I made my first jar of sauerkraut, I really did not understand fermentation. I did not understand what was happening in that jar. But when you think about it, that we can slice up cabbage very finely, we can mix salt with it, create a brine, and pack that into the jar. And underneath that brine, things are happening. Within a few days, it's bubbling away. What's causing those bubbles? And then before we know it, we're getting this nice aroma. The colors are fading. Things are changing. You taste it at the very beginning. It tastes sweet and salty. And then by a week later, it's got this tangy flavor to it. And 2 or 3 weeks later, it's ready to help your gut health. And it's like, how did that happen? It's this microbial world out there, and those microbes are working for us. They make this transformation happen. And it's rather remarkable that we can, in such a simple manner, create a food that nourishes us. And these ancient cultures knew that intuitively. They probably did not know what was going on in their ferments, but they knew that it was healthy cultures needed it for their health. And so they consumed these fermented foods and stayed healthy and had those beautiful broad palates and nice strong teeth.
When I made my first sauerkraut, I know one of the things that came to my mind is, how am I going to do this without water? I didn't realize that when you press down on the cabbage and the salt, that then it forms this water. Were you the same way when you were first making
Oh,
it?
exactly. When you first do it and you have no concept, and at that time, there were only two books out there to teach fermentation. There was no YouTube, there were no websites, there was no Amazon. You couldn't just go buy these gizmos. You were able to find some of the traditional crocks, but you're shooting in the dark and it's like, how does this work? And then as you work with it, you learn more and more and you play around. Does it matter what type of salt I use? Does it matter what time of year I do it? Does it matter what type of cabbage I use? And so that's where all the questions I had. And that would evolve to teaching people how to make it. But it's like, where does that brine come from? People think you add vinegar. There's no need for vinegar. It's making its own vinegar, lactic acid, to preserve it, to give it the same tang as vinegar, but with the benefits that don't come with the pasteurized sauerkraut with the vinegar thrown in there.
Right. Vinegar was a thing made popular by the Heinz company as a way to prolong products' shelf lives in supermarkets.
Right. And by doing that, they took away our gut health. All these little things crept in of, let's make our flour white. They took away all the nutrients. Let's make our sugar white. They took away the nutrients. Let's make those pickles all taste the same and look the same. But then you throw in the preservatives. And so all these foods that traditional cultures ate as a part of their daily diet, the raw cheeses, the raw milk, the sauerkrauts, the pickles, the sourdough bread that was pre-digested for you, all those got taken away through our manufacturing process. And so, just on the side, I say add a forkful of sauerkraut to your diet, then on autopilot, you're taking care of your gut health. But all that's been removed from our diet by big pharma, big ag, etc.
A lot of my favorite foods that you're mentioning. And I think one of the best ways to learn how to make sauerkraut is in a class. As a Western Price chapter leader. We did one years ago about making kraut. I think it was one of the best ones. And since then, I love the idea of doing very much hands-on interactive meetings for a chapter. I think those are some of the best ones that we do.
I think what drew me to kimchi is it's integrated into the culture. It's a part of their lifestyle. They bring families together and they sit on the floor and they chop the cabbage and they salt it and they make their kimchi. It's a part of their culture. So they grew up making it and working together with people and sharing the microbial community from all those different people. And so they didn't need someone to teach them. They just did it with their neighbors and their culture. And every November is Kimjong season in Korea. And you all gathered together on the plaza with hundreds of people and many, many pounds of Napa cabbage. And so that became a part of your lifestyle. And we've lost that. So like you say, by having those workshops and the hand-on and people being able to look up a Weston A. Price chapter and find a local community that they can work with to learn this process, it's wonderful.
We've also done a kimchi demo as well, where people learn how to make kimchi. So another great one. Yes, and I would say that these are ones that are the best starting ones. I know pickles are one of the ferments that people are most familiar with, but pickles are a little more intermediate, I would say, in learning how to ferment.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I think it's because when I first started fermenting, I'd made a batch of sauerkraut every full moon. I didn't tie it into the seasonality of it. Fermentation is a way to preserve the local harvest. So when people run it with cabbage, cabbage stores well, same with the Napa cabbage. So you can get away with making it off season when those cabbages were picked months ago, weeks ago, whatever. And you can get away with getting a good ferment with it. But when it comes to pickles, they need to be a specific type of pickle for fermentation, which is different than vinegar pickling. It's a different type of cucumber you use. And they really need to be fresh picked. If those sit around for months, have been shipped from across the country, you're going to struggle with it. So I think that's what makes making cucumber pickles intermediate type ferment, is because people want to make it year round, or they don't have access to those nice fresh cucumbers that make great pickles. And when you have that, they do become quite easy to make. But again, people aren't completely tuned into understanding that fermentation is a way to preserve foods. It's not a way to, oh, it's June, I want to make pickled radishes. That may work, but you have to tune in to the seasons and get to know your local farmers and go to the farmer's market and use the things that you find fresh picked as a way to direct you on what you should be fermenting.
Yes, to make pickles, you need what's known as pickling cucumbers. And I actually found pickling cucumbers for the first time at the farmer's market yesterday, and I started making my first batch, but they don't make them year round because I know people, when they've been over my house, they always want my pickles. I remember at the beginning of this year, they're like, where are the pickles? I said, no, my pickling cucumber season is over. And they don't work as well because I know people have tried making pickles with other ones like the Persian cucumbers, and it doesn't really work to ferment with those kind of cucumbers.
Right. But I'm glad that you can get away with making sauerkraut and kimchi year-round, because when people want to learn, they want to learn. You want to grab them at that opportunity so they can learn when the energy is there and the inspiration is there. So it's nice that it's not quite as finicky as the cucumber pickles.
Right. So definitely sauerkraut and kimchi are the first ones to learn with. And I know you also say, in addition to starting your fermentation learning with them, your health can start with something as simple as a fork full of sauerkraut or kimchi.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just so easy to add to any meal. It actually tastes good on top of your morning eggs, or if you're making a salad at lunch, it works in very well to mix it in with that. If it's a flavor you're not used to, you can put it into a sandwich and it just brings alive the flavors. It's an effortless way to turn yourself into a five-star chef because you're adding umami to your dish. And umami is what chefs use as their secret for good meals, is they're adding tomato paste, they're adding Parmesan cheese, they're adding these umami-rich flavors to a meal, and it awakens the taste buds. And you could have a bland hamburger that just doesn't quite taste nice. You add a forkful of sauerkraut to that, and all of a sudden your taste buds are alive and the flavors just pop because we're adding fermented foods to that meal.
I'm a burger lover, so I love that analogy. As we're talking about this, we've both made sauerkraut, and we know how it's a very simple dish that you can make. And obviously those that are very involved with Weston Price who are listening, they know that. But we've got some other listeners who are just getting into real food, listening to this podcast right now, that probably have those common fears and misconceptions about fermenting at home. So how do you help people like that?
Number one, if they're afraid of it and afraid it's going to make them sick, fermented foods, there's never been a case of food poisoning with naturally fermented vegetables. On their own, when those microbes are there, they're creating a safe environment. There's no way in that salty brine that the pathogenic bacteria can live. If you compare it to a green salad or coleslaw, you could have rinsed that salad, that spinach very well, cleaned it off, and there still could be E. coli living in a little nestled into the leaves that you could not quite wash off. And so you could be eating a green salad thinking it's safer than that sauerkraut you're leaving to ferment on your counter for weeks. It breaks all type of food safe rules, but actually that sauerkraut is safer because the bacteria that you have welcomed into that jar, they create an environment where the pathogenic bacteria cannot live. They lower the pH of it to make it acidic again to create an environment that's perfectly safe. Whereas that green salad, you're not taking the microbes into the environment. You're just eating that fresh green salad that could have the E. coli on, and you could ingest it. If your gut microbiome isn't up to snuff, you could get food poisoning or get sick from that. So, number one, to realize that fermentation is very, very safe. If you were to mess it up, you would know the minute you opened up that jar. There would be a smell that would be so off-putting that there's no way you would eat it. You might see layers of mold in there that you just go, I can't touch this. So that would be the first one, is to realize that it is a very safe process. And then the other one is fermentation is a science. And so as part of that science, we need to use it with the science people in the lab would use a digital scale. And the reason for that digital scale is to make sure we're using the right amount of salt. I did not use a scale to begin with, and you can get away with going by taste, but to encourage the correct bacteria to live in that jar and to kill off the pathogenic bacteria, there's a 2% salt concentration. And that's about a tablespoon of salt to a jar of sauerkraut, which is about 800 grams or 1.75 pounds fit nicely into a quart jar. So by using a digital scale, we can add the correct amount of salt so that everything happens and unfolds beautifully. The first time I made it, I went by taste. You can mix in that salt and taste your shredded cabbage. If it tastes salty like a potato chip, you know you have the right amount. If it tastes way too salty like a ocean seawater, it's a little bit too much. If you're not tasting the salt, you need a little bit more. It's hard to go by taste, so that's why I switched over to using the scale to add the correct amount of salt. But if you add too much, you're slowing things down. If you don't add enough, you're encouraging the molds and yeast. And to think about it like you're making coleslaw, that you're slicing cabbage finely, you're adding in some other flavoring ingredients, and instead of working to make a dressing, you're putting salt on. And that salt creates your brine dressing. That salt pulls the liquid out of the cabbage cells, creates a brine, and then you're going to pack into a jar. It's going to sit below that brine. And if people are hesitant to get started, I always say invite a friend over. When you have it scheduled like that, it's on the calendar, you know it's going to happen, and then you have someone to bounce ideas off of and go back and forth and go, are we doing this right? Should we do this or that? And not be afraid to make mistakes. The jar's going to tell you if you did something wrong. And you have to stumble and experiment and play around with it a few times to learn. Those are all the tips I share on my website. I used to use Celtic sea salt because I love the natural evaporated sea salt. I found that many times I was not adding enough salt. A dry salt like Himalayan pink or a real salt has a much more consistent sodium content to it. So I found out through stumbling that these batches taste musty. There's not quite enough salt in here. So then I switched to a different salt and was able to get my numbers more correct. But it's a very forgiving process, and that jar has a lot to teach you. Get your family involved and invite a friend over and learn together through the process.
That's an excellent description of how to address people's fears about fermenting and getting it right. I love everything that you include. We talk about classes, but obviously, if you don't have the time or it's not class near you, just find one other person. And I love how you address the idea of it going bad, that we're not saying that it can't, but it's very easily detectable, like you said, due to smell.
Right. And I remember so many times when I have gotten like mold. If you see mold or undergrowth, the bacteria are not necessarily bad. They're out of balance. And so that's what we're trying to do by doing all these steps correctly, bring things back into balance. But that mold, generally, you can catch it early on. You just scoop it out. But if you forget the jar and it sits there for a few weeks, you go, oh my goodness, what happened? I was ready to dump the whole jar into my compost bin. So I was scooping off the top layer so that stuff would fall out of the jar. And underneath that layer of mold was this beautiful, aromatic, perfectly preserved sauerkraut. You think of our great-great-grandmothers, they had the crock down in the basement, and sometimes they would develop a layer of mold on the top. And they would lift it back so that mold grew on the top. But that's a personal preference on whether you see the mold and remove it and eat what's beneath it. Some people are very sensitive to molds, and they would say, you can read both directions on the internet, throw the whole thing out, start over, or remove the mold off the top. So that's a personal call. But again, that jar is teaching you something. Why did I get that mold? What went wrong? And that's where you adjust things and come back and you just keep learning with it.
The thing with learning about fermentation is a lot of these words that sound bad, we've learned that they're actually not bad things. Because I think sometimes people, when they hear fermentation, they think of when a food goes bad, that it's fermented. And things such as, we talk about good bacteria, a lot of people only associate bacteria as being a bad thing.
Yeah, that's what we grew up with. And that's what the food corporations want us to buy, all these things in nice, neat packages that are ready to eat. It takes work to make foods that are going to nourish your gut. You can't buy them off the shelf. You have to get in the kitchen and make them. And that's what's this time-honored process, like out of in Korea, it's a part of their culture. And they take the time for it. They honor the time in the kitchen. And we moved away from that. We've been told that's a waste of your time, but it's such a way to nourish not only your soul through the process and the learning of fermentation, but to nourish your family. We need to put more focus back on our foods and making our own foods.
Yes, it's a part of the Koreans' culture, literally and figuratively.
Yes, exactly.
I love those puns. You could say it's my tradition.
That's right.
I like to keep them alive.
And they are alive. And by these fermented foods, we really don't understand the magic that's happening with fermentation. We don't understand how we're learning more and more, but people want to go the quick way and take the probiotic capsule. It's easy. You pop it in, you're done. Well, there may be 10 strains of bacteria in there, but they've looked at kimchi and there's over 100 strains of bacteria. And they don't quite know how they're working together. But when you get that real food down in your gut knows how to use it. There's a reason for all those different bacteria in there, and they know how to work in your gut and take care of the pathogenic and keep you healthy. We can't outguess this microbial community and think we can go into a lab and create it. We have to trust that the bacteria can do that for us in that jar, in that crock of whatever we're fermenting.
As you mentioned, the two that you teach at sauerkraut, and then you've also gotten into kimchi. What are the differences between the two of them in terms of flavor, process, and benefits?
Yeah, so flavor-wise, number one, there are over 400 or 500 varieties of kimchi, but we'll focus on the Napa cabbage kimchi that people are most familiar with, that is made with Napa cabbage and radishes and some vegetables, and then they include in fish sauce generally, and salted shrimp, and then gochugaru. Gochugaru is a Korean red pepper that gives it that beautiful fiery red color, and you can determine how much heat you want in there. But kimchi is more microbial diverse because of the added fish sauce in there, the garlic, the salted shrimp, and this rice paste that you're making. Sauerkraut has the microbial diversity, but not in the way that kimchi is. So there's two different ferments. Kimchi is going to have more variety of bacteria in it, but they both have plenty in there. The fermentation process with cabbage, with sauerkraut, you're slicing up a green head of cabbage very finely, and you're trying to create a brine that everything's going to live below. So it's a brine ferment. It's fermented with lactic acid. Same thing with kimchi. But with kimchi, it's a paste ferment, which means that you soak your vegetables first in the brine, or you layer the leaves with salt. But the easier way to make kimchi is a chopped Napa cabbage kimchi. So we soak the vegetables in the brine first, and that's where we're setting up the safe microbial community. But then we're going to drain those vegetables and we're going to squeeze the excess brine out of it. Sauerkraut, we're trying to keep as much brine as possible. Kimchi, we're trying to get rid of the brine after we soak the vegetables. Then we wrap it in, mix it and coat it with this beautiful red paste. You make this red paste with the rice flour and the gochugaru and the fish sauce and the salted shrimp and the garlic and the ginger. And then you wrap the ferment in that. You mix the vegetables with that and pack it into the jar. You're not having to keep it below the brine. And with sauerkraut, you're keeping it below the brine and fermenting it for 3 to 4 weeks. With kimchi, you're letting it sit in this paste and you're letting it ferment on your counter for about a week. The Koreans will even eat it as fresh kimchi, not even fermented. They're eating it at different stages. And at those different stages, they're getting different type of microbial action going on. Then with kimchi, you move it to the refrigerator and let it develop its flavor for another 2 to 3 weeks. So they're both fermenting for, say, a month, but sauerkraut is fermenting for that time on your kitchen counter. Kimchi is being wrapped in a paste, fermented on your kitchen counter for a week, and then 2 to 3 weeks to develop the flavor in the refrigerator.
Yes, and you touched briefly upon how some people are doing a kimchi that's made a little bit more like sauerkraut. I've seen a lot of that, essentially, a kimchi kraut, which is actually one of my favorites.
Yes, I have a recipe in my book for that, and I call it kimchi-style sauerkraut. It's made just like sauerkraut, fermented under the brine for the 3 to 4 weeks, but we add in all the flavors. We add in the gochugaru and the fish sauce, so you have a similar flavor profile. Because with kimchi, it's more of a process that goes the whole day. It's not necessarily more time, but we have to first soak the napa cabbage for 6 to 8 hours in this brine. You're not doing anything while it's soaking, but you had to prepare it and wait that 6 to 8 hours. Then you're having to make the rice flour paste and blend in all the seasonings. So it's more of a process that you weave into your day and come back and check on it and do the next step. Whereas sauerkraut, you can do it in 20 minutes, have it in the jar, you're done. And so that's why it's nice to have the options of doing your kimchi style sauerkraut to get the flavors and the benefits of the kimchi, because you're adding in the different fermented products into there. Whereas with kimchi, you're having to wait for it to go through these stages. And it can be made vegan. So people that are afraid of hearing about fish sauce and salted shrimp, you can easily substitute in miso and other products. But I like miso the best because it's a fermented product that has that depth of flavor that you would find in your fish sauce. So you can substitute that miso in for kimchi. So if you're afraid of eating kimchi because you're vegan or vegetarian, that's a good substitute. You can still enjoy your kimchi.
Yes, miso is a safe way to consume soy because it's a fermented version of it.
Yeah, that's a good point to pick out, because all these traditional cultures that Weston A. Price studied and the cookbook that Sally Fallon put together, Nourishing Traditions, it was not just what these people ate, but it was how they prepared it. And so soybeans were always fermented. That was the only way that they would consume the soybeans. And sourdough bread, we fermented the grain first so that it was pre-digested and you got the extra nutrients out of it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned with the kimchi style sauerkraut that it has the brine in it, which is what I love so much about it, because when I have a kimchi kraut, I will actually save the brine and do gut shots with it.
Yes, exactly. And gut shots have become popular because people want a quick way to get the benefits of fermentation, but maybe they can't handle the fiber. They want a quick way to get it. So there is a company that makes gut shots, but when in essence, gut shots are the brine from a ferment. And then you can use that brine in salad dressings. You can use it just for the flavor. You can add it to alcoholic drinks, all sorts of things you can do with that brine and
yes,
still get the same benefits.
I've seen a few companies make gut shots, but I found the easiest way is just to save it myself from the ones that I get or the ones that I make. Yeah. And as we're talking about kimchi and sauerkraut, I've noticed that a lot of cultures have versions of sauerkraut. Sauerkraut is best known with the German culture and kimchi best known with Korean. I know there's other ones too, like curtido.
Right. Yeah. So I focused on the sauerkraut. I developed over 20 recipes. I think the book has at least 23 recipes in there and pulled from different cultures. There are curditos in there. And then a lot of them are just flavors that I love put together. One of my first ones was passion pink sauerkraut, and that's grated beets in your sauerkraut, along with garlic and cumin seeds. There's a Hawaiian sauerkraut in there, which is chopped up pineapple with lime juice and zest and cilantro. And so when people think sauerkraut, you don't need to be in this narrow focus that I'm making what they did serve on hot dogs, but I'm making it the natural way. Sauerkraut is a beautiful way to bring in all sorts of flavors, whatever is currently in your garden or at the market. And then you can have that sauerkraut appeal to different members of the family. The teaching recipe that I do to teach the process has grated carrots and garlic in it. It's a very child-friendly sauerkraut. It's one of people's favorites, because you're softening the tang or the bite of the cabbage in there by adding in the carrots and play around a little bit with the flavor there.
I like the beet sauerkraut. Is that somewhat a take on beet kvass?
Nothing at all like beet kvass. But that was just an inspiration. There's another rosemary beet one I put in there that is rosemary and beets and garlic. Beet kvass is a fermented drink where you take chopped up beets and salt and let them ferment, and you're drinking the liquid off of that. It's very hard for people to get used to the flavor because it's not a flavor we're used to. So I wouldn't compare the two at all.
Yes. And you touched a little earlier, and I just wanted to talk a little more about why you emphasize traditional fermentation over store-bought options or probiotic supplements.
Right, exactly. So it's a whole food. If you're buying probiotic supplements, they're quick and easy, but you're only getting under a dozen strains depending on what that lab has decided to put together. Whereas you're making your own probiotics when you're fermenting sauerkraut, and you have a wide variety of bacteria in there, and they're discovering more and more, and they're working in a symbiotic fashion, working in your gut in a whole different fashion than the single strains. When you're traditionally fermenting sauerkraut, you're not adding anything but salt. There's no vinegar in there. There's no water in there. We're relying upon the salt and the bacteria for the fermentation to happen. So we're slicing up the cabbage. We're adding the salt. The salt is there to set up a nice environment for the bacteria and to pull the liquid out to create the brine. The bacteria then eat the sugars and starches in your ingredients. So the sugars and starches in the cabbage, the carrots, etc. They produce their lactobacillus bacteria. They produce lactic acid. And that lactic acid is your preservative. And so that's why you can keep the sauerkraut for over a year and still have beautiful, delicious ferment that is healthy and full of beneficial bacteria. The stuff that you buy in the can would be heat processed. They add the vinegar to make it have that tangy flavor to it, but the heat process is going to kill off all the enzymes in the bacteria. So when you're wanting a live food, you want to rely upon the bacteria to make it for you. And then that's going to actually work much better in your gut too. The canned sauerkraut, you're still going to get the fiber from it, but you're not going to get the enzymes and the probiotics.
As you mentioned, you have the book Mouthwatering Sauerkraut, which was just released. You've talked about how when you first learned about this, there are basically two books, and obviously there have been many books released since. So what sets your book apart from these other ones?
I guess because one book I read back about 15 years ago, it allows you to master one ferment that becomes a foundation in your household with your meals. I always keep sauerkraut and kimchi in my refrigerator because it's just a go-to condiment I'm adding to all my meals. And so I want people to master one skill, and it's a great skill to master to begin with. And if you never get any further than sauerkraut or kimchi, that's fine. You've already taken care of a foundation for good gut health. But the skills that you learn with making sauerkraut or kimchi can easily be transferred to kombucha, to making sour cream, to making sourdough bread. And it gives you this confidence to go, okay, I've mastered this one skill. Where can I go with it? I just like the idea of taking a ferment that's easy to do, helping people master that skill, get that confidence, and see the change in gut health within even a week of consuming their sauerkraut. And people can notice a difference with bloating, et cetera, energy. When I open a lot of the fermentation books there that cover 50 different topics, I become overwhelmed. I'm inspired and I like the recipes in there, but I don't know where to start. So by focusing just on the sauerkraut and kimchi, it gives people a place to start and a skill to master that then they can feel confident and feel connected to this microbial world and begin to understand how important it is to take care of our gut health.
Yes, I would agree with that because just about all the fermentation books that I can think of, they focus on so many types of ferments that you can make. I can't think of anyone that does just sauerkraut, and I think that's a great idea to have it focus just on mastering what's probably the best first ferment to learn, and you go more into depth of types of sauerkrauts than any of the other books have.
Yeah, right. And I had first self-published on Amazon almost 10 years ago. And then I was approached by a publisher and we republished it. So this is a republished version of the original book. And then we added the kimchi to it to give people that kind of choice of what ferment they want to start with.
Oh, I think that's a great success story. Are there some sauerkrauts that you've specifically created yourself, mixing different foods into it?
Pretty much all the recipes in there are ones I have created myself, being inspired by other ferments I've seen. being inspired by a book called The Flavor Bible that teaches you how to blend flavors together. I think that's where my cardamom beet sauerkraut came from, because I looked up beets and what flavors pair well with beets, etc. So most of them, like my turkey dinner one, there's one that has rosemary, sage, and thyme in it. So I'm looking at other dishes out there to create, but most of those recipes in there were totally created on my own.
Nice.
You're inspired by other things out there. So they're not, quote, all original, but they're an inspiration of other flavors I came across that I thought would meld together nicely.
Right. And as part of this also, for people who maybe don't like sauerkraut, don't even like cabbage in general, you can include foods that they like with it that may get them into trying sauerkraut for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so important. Traditional cultures, like I said, there's not one traditional culture out there that were healthy, studied by Weston A. Price, that did not include some type of fermented food with their diet. And I'm not perfect. There are times when that jar doesn't get pulled out or I run out and I can go a couple of weeks without my sauerkraut, but I notice a difference. I notice when it's no longer in my diet. I was healthy to begin with, so I didn't come to learning to ferment from a health crisis. I came to it more to improve my health that I already had. And so I didn't notice a drastic health change when I started it, but I did notice when I traveled and didn't have it with me, I now always bring it with me when I travel, that my gut health slowed way down, digestion slowed way down. I noticed at one time I eat sweet things. They're not completely out of my diet, but all of a sudden, anytime I ate something sugary, it went right through me. And I go, gosh, I haven't had sauerkraut in a week. What's going on? I added the sauerkraut back to my diet and things leveled out fine. So I know how advantageous it is. And it's just helping people find a quick way to take care of their health. We need to own our health and not outsource it to our doctors. And so when we see little things going on and going, okay, what can we do to take care of it? That's the power I'm trying to give back to people, that you can start listening to these symptoms and trying to figure out that what you can do with your body to take care of it.
One of the best sauerkrauts I've seen for getting people into it, because like we've talked about pickles, which are harder to make, but they're a very popular ferment, is I've seen dill pickle sauerkraut, either the flavor or putting in a little slices of cucumber. And that's one where you don't necessarily need pickling cucumbers because you can slice up the cucumbers.
Yes, exactly. And Trader Joe's makes one like that. Actually, that was one of my recipes I was developing for the book and just didn't quite like the texture of the cucumbers in there. I could never quite nail it down. And so I pulled it out. But yes, that's a way where people can easily take those cucumbers at any time and add them into their sauerkraut. They can get inspired to do all sorts of things with those ingredients. And yeah, it's fun to play around with.
It is, yeah. It's fun to play around with. And learning how to ferment in a jar, many lessons and connections come from learning from that. What would you say are some of those?
Number one, those bacteria are so powerful. And it's amazing what they can do for us. And we don't understand that till we take that jar and see the transformation and see what it can do for our gut health. And so that's teaching us how the simple fermented food can take care of us and can improve our gut health and can teach us that the bacteria are not to be feared. They're there to welcome into our lives. I especially like the connection to my local community, that if I want good cabbage, I would need to get it locally from a good source. And so then all of a sudden I'm going to my farmers markets and I'm talking to the farmers. And the more that we can connect with our farmers and get our food direct from them, the healthier we're going to be as a society. And that, yes, I'm going to buy avocado shipped from around the world, but the more that I can buy locally, and then that actual fermentation process, when a jar goes south or when it doesn't quite turn out, I'm learning how much salt to add, how thinly to slice that cabbage, the temperature in my kitchen. Is that going to make a difference if I try to make sauerkraut in the middle of a hot summer versus in winter, and how that impacts it? So it's always teaching you something. Even today, I'm still learning something from those jars I ferment in. That's what's neat about the process. It never ends. You can always be curious and find something neat to be excited about.
It's an amazing process. And yes, I hope that this podcast is getting listeners who aren't already fermenting excited to want to do it themselves. And hopefully that it does. What are the first steps that these people should take if they want to start fermenting at home?
I would say to head to my website, and I have on there getting started, and there's a whole page on how to make sauerkraut, and it takes you through step by step with lots and lots of tips. So I would direct people to either my kimchi recipe on the website or the sauerkraut. Sauerkraut is great to start with. Kimchi is also beautiful. It's just a slightly different drawn out process, but to go through the steps and get started.
Wonderful. So you have this website and you have a book which was just picked up and republished by a publisher after being self-published. What's in the future for you? Do you have plans for more books, upcoming classes? Let's hear all about it.
So I do have some online classes and I want to expand on that. That seems to be for the people that have been following me for a while or first find me. They're liking the online classes. I want to get back to teaching local classes and even going into high schools and grade schools and teaching kids directly to catch them at a younger age. I'm also putting together a fermentation summit so that more people learn about fermentation.
Love
and
it.
Bring more people together to get a taste, like a taste sampler of all the different ferments and see what you're drawn to. I don't know what book is in my future. I know there's another one, but I don't quite know what to focus it on. That will come to me because I like the single focus of sauerkraut, that I'm not competing with 20 other fermentation books out there. But to expand my repertoire of online classes and then take those local also.
And I know another thing that you're involved with is the hashtag 10K Jar Challenge. What is it and how can people get involved?
So the 10K Jar Challenge is, my goal has always been just to get sauerkraut and kimchi fermenting in homes, to get people motivated to realize how easy it is to take charge of their own health. And so by learning to ferment, you develop this confidence on, I can make this. So the 10K Jar Challenge is, I want to get sauerkraut or kimchi, whatever, fermenting in 10,000 homes around the world. So I put up a page on my website, the 10K Jar Challenge, and all it is to ferment something, take a picture of it, and put it up on the website with a little story behind your jar of sauerkraut. And then I'm giving out prizes where this just started less than a month ago with the launch of my book. And the idea is to post that on there, and then I'll do prizes every so often. So I have prizes for my favorite sauerkraut and kimchi fermentation equipment and gochugaru, et cetera, to get people started and motivated. And also to see, my jars can look really nice, and you can see the photographs in the book. They're all pretty and beautiful. And it's nice to see what other people's jars at home look like, and that you can do this.
That's great. We're just about out of time, but before I go, would you like to let the listeners know anything more about sauerkraut and kimchi?
Don't be afraid to try it. It's not going to poison yourself, and you're not going to poison your family with it. It's going to awaken your taste buds and bring all sorts of cool connections and learnings to you. So don't be afraid to try it. And even if you eat just one little strand of it, you're still getting lots of beneficial bacteria. So start with one strand and then add a little bit more each day.
Wonderful. And for people that want to learn more about this, as you mentioned, they can go on your website. You also have social media accounts. Let's hear where they can find all of those.
So yes, my website where most of the information lies is at makesauerkraut.com. There's a lot of postings on Facebook and Pinterest. That's the main social channels. But yeah, the book can be found there. Go check it out and see what you can find to inspire you. Invite that friend over and buy that head of cabbage and get started.
And if they want to go and learn about it on social media, what are the handles?
They're under Make Sauerkraut too.
Perfect.
Pinterest is under Make Sauerkraut. Facebook is, Instagram is. So they're all with Make Sauerkraut.
Well, it's been absolutely delightful spending a whole show all about sauerkraut and kimchi.
Amazing. We could talk just on that.
Oh, there's plenty. Yes. I've done many shows before. And yes, there's, I think, room for talk about it again.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you too. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.